This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Distracted driving kills about 100 people in Missouri each year, according to the Missouri Department of Transportation. The state has begun enforcement of a new distracted driving law to bring down that statistic. Using a cell phone behind the wheel without hands-free technology can now come with fees of hundreds of dollars. The law is named in part to honor Randall Siddons, who was working as a volunteer at an event at Mizzou when a driver struck and killed him. The driver was on FaceTime. Randall's wife, Adrian, has since been an advocate for change. St. Louis Public Radio's Abby Larico spoke with Adrian about how the event changed her life, what the process of petitioning for legislation has taught her, and how she worked through her grief to make change at the state level. Abby started the conversation by asking Adrian about her late husband.
Randall, his interests. I could talk all day about his interests. He was a little more extroverted personality, outgoing, could and would do anything. He could play music. He was involved in running and triathlons. He was a carpenter. He remodeled our house. He has had so many activities, but like, I don't know, I feel like the core of him was like to find out what you're like, to sit down with perfect strangers or really good friends and to like, what's your interest? And he'd be super engaged in that. And then he would find that super fascinating. Then he would go home and research it and like discover like, and like be really engaged. And then the next time you talked, he would know more about it. And so he could like talk to you. And like, I don't know, he was listening to a podcast and heard someone passionately talking about kidney donation and how like if more people donated kidneys, you know, less people would, you know, there's so many people that need them and like you have two and you have a spare and like just describing and like talking about all this stuff. And I came home that day. He's like, hey, I think I want to donate my kidney. Okay, I'm gonna need more information, but okay.
Really?
And he did. He, when I was pregnant with our first child, he donated a kidney to a perfect stranger. Just random person. He didn't know who he's donating it to. And because he did that, like because he donated to just some random person, whoever he matched with, he did a chain. So like they started a chain, and so multiple people got kidneys. Anyway, and so he was, you know, he had done all this research into it and he was like, yeah, I'm going to do that. And like everyone should do that. And then he would talk to people about how like this is a cool thing you can do.
How does that align with you and your personality?
So I always described myself as like, so he was always the one that had the idea, the dream, the big idea. And then I'm the like little worker bee who actually goes and makes some of that happen. okay, you have the plan, you have the dream, I can help you get there.
You mentioned running. I know that the events leading up to his death happened at a running event. Mm-hmm. Can you walk me through that day a little bit?
So he was working, he was scheduled to work. It's the Tri-Zoo Triathlon. It's a sprint triathlon, so shorter race. He had to be up and at the race site at like 3:30. So he woke me up before he left and said goodbye, and he went to the race. And then I checked in with him later that morning, and, you know, they were set up. The race was getting ready to start. Great, having a great day. All right, I'll see you afterwards about lunchtime. So my day was normal, you know, up with the kids, getting them food, watching some movies with them, doing some laundry, nothing crazy. And then I start getting phone calls I don't recognize. And from numbers, I'm like, I don't know that number. I'm not going to answer. Like, I don't know who this number that is. And, then I start getting voicemails. So I was checking my voicemails and it's the hospital calling me to tell me that Randall's been admitted to the hospital with serious injuries and I need to come to the hospital. Like, I'm in go mode as far as like, okay, I'm trying to figure out all the things I need to be doing right then. Mm-hmm. But I don't really know how concerned I need to be. I just know that I am. Like, so, like I had a pit in my like My heart was sank. I was just like, something is not good. And so we get to the hospital, and pretty quickly a doctor comes out and gets me, and takes me to an exam room and goes through the list of his injuries. And then I started freaking out. He had a head injury. He'd broken multiple bones. He broke his humerus, his pelvis. Both of his knees were injured, bleeding. He had internal bleeding, massive head injury. He was unconscious. He did go. He was breathing on his own when he got to the hospital. So that was like the one thing I was clinging to. Okay, he was breathing on his own when he got here. Like, he was never non-responsive, as far as he could always breathe on his own. But anyway, I had to have Ryan call everybody. So I like just kept handing him the phone. I'm like, I can't say it without starting to cry, because now I am going into worst case scenarios of like, is he going to make it through this procedure?
It wasn't just, oh, one injury. It was things that you knew from your experience.
Yeah.
Those added up to.
This adds up to, he may not make it out of that surgery. Like, he may not come out of this. And so, you know, like, if it's just a broken bone, like, that's fixable. Like, bones, you can fix bones. We can fix that. Knees, he may never run again. We can fix those. He could walk. Brain injuries and internal bleeding, to the extent that they were describing, I was like, he may not come out of the surgery. And so he did. He came out, made it through surgery, but still the brain injury was the one that, you know, and looking back over the course of everything, like, if we could have had all the injuries minus the brain injury, he'd still be here. We spent a month in the surgical ICU at University Hospital. Like I said, I was like 4 to 5 months pregnant at the time, two little kids at home, no childcare, because he was their childcare. Yeah, but after the month being in the ICU, we were transferred to a Madonna Rehabilitation in Lincoln, Nebraska. It's a spinal cord and brain injury rehabilitation facility, to see if, you know, there was any more progress that could be made.
Was he ever conscious?
No. And he kept having, you know, recurrences of pneumonia, an aspiration, and things just weren't going in the right direction. The last time he was septic, and his kidney was failing, and he donated one, so he only had one. So he went into kidney failure. The stacking of all the injuries, it just, he was never set up for a good prognosis on recovery. And he wasn't, like I said, he wasn't responsive really. So my youngest daughter was born in October. So, she was born in October. And then, so I couldn't travel back up there, for a couple weeks. So about the time she was born was about the time he was kind of starting to have complications again. And we were back up there. Me and just Gemma were up there. And so he got to meet her. But ultimately it culminates with me making the decision just to stop treatment. Like, we never did dialysis for the kidney failure. Just because, again, it buys you time, but for what?
I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. It's what happened. But, you know, and that's the thing I say about that, is that, like, we had, after the original injuries and things like that, you always have hope that they'll recover. And, you know, you don't want to give up hope. But along the way, you know, it was evident probably earlier than that he was never going to recover. And in some ways, it was an easy decision, because he was not the person who wanted to live in a wheelchair in a hospital. Like, he would not have wanted anybody to keep him alive just for the sake of being alive. So that was an easy enough decision. It's an impossible decision, even though, you know, like, I've had the conversation. Like, we had had the conversation. Mm. Like, hey, what happens if one of us gets injured? And, like, and it always made me so mad because I was like, I don't even want to think about this.
And this whole process, you have mm-hmm. so much going on. You have the constantly, you know, the evolution of his care and treatment. Mm-hmm. You have the growing body inside of you that is your daughter.
Yeah.
And this is all happening, and that's enough to fill anyone's world. But there's mm-hmm. another factor in this, which is the how everything happens.
Sure.
At what point did you start learning more about the circumstances that put Randall in the hospital that day that started all this?
That day. Actually, before I found out, while he was in surgery, a police officer came to the hospital to talk to me to give me kind of an update on what they knew up until that point. All I knew was that she had been speeding and she somehow swerved and had crashed into them. And then over the course of the next, you know, weeks to month, they had completed, like, their investigation and knew all of the details and of, like, how fast she was actually going and, like, okay, traffic was – she was coming up to stop traffic. Like, they were stopped. And I knew, like, he was in – he had neon everything on. He had a police escort, had lights on, his truck had lights on it. Like, they were in the Konoff Lane. It was about 10:30 in the morning, blue skies, like, not, you know, it wasn't raining. There was no, like, weather conditions that had happened, anything like that. And then, she was driving and video chatting on her phone and just not paying attention, speeding, reckless driving. She was going to hurt somebody that day, just happened to be my husband.
Listing off, again, everything that you had going on there, I can't mm-hmm. really imagine such a gamut of emotions. Mm-hmm. But to bring an element like that into it, were you angry?
In the moment, in the time, I was angry, but I didn't have time to be angry because Randall is still alive. And so I was really hyper-focused on whatever medical situation we were dealing with that day, right?
You literally had to triage your emotions.
Yes. I couldn't be angry because I didn't have time to have that emotion right then. Yes, I was angry, but that was I had to have people deal. I really had to delegate and compartmentalize who was dealing with what, and I was not dealing with anger.
How much had you thought about phone use behind the wheel before this incident?
I definitely had thought about it because it, you know, there's always been something, right? It was CDs, it was tapes, and now it's cell phones. And so I definitely had thought about it significantly, but not to the extent of, oh, well, there's no law that says this is wrong. There's nothing actually protecting victims of these injuries. Like, because it's not illegal. She technically was not doing anything illegal. You know, we had a texting law that said if you were under 21, you couldn't text. But it gave permission to – it basically gives you, like, oh, well, once you're over 21, you're adult enough to be able to manage driving and texting. But it didn't talk about – you know, and that's part of the problem with laws in general is that they don't evolve fast enough with technology.
Missouri wound up being the 49th state to outlaw texting and driving for mm-hmm. everyone. That kind of surprised me, but at the same time, maybe it shouldn't have.
Yeah. Missouri, I love this state. I do. But they just – and everyone talks about how, you know, well, we're the show me state. You have to, like, prove to us that, like, things need to happen. And I don't know. I definitely see that more as a detriment to our state now. Like, we literally are so hard-headed that we can't see reason – like, we have to literally be the last one before we're going to do something. Like, everyone else has to do it first and prove that it's a good thing to do before we're like, oh, maybe we should maybe mm-hmm. talk about this now.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I kind of put us as 50th in the sense that we're only behind Montana.
Montana.
Population-wise, yeah. It doesn't, but they have like city and like local laws that cover it more extensively than Missouri does.
Wow.
So we're even like, yes, we're technically ahead of them, but we're mostly behind them.
We're listening to Abby Larico's conversation with Adrienne Siddons about her push for Missouri's new law that penalizes the use of cell phone use behind the wheel without hands-free technology. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back. We're listening to Abby Larico's conversation with Adrienne Siddons, whose husband Randall was killed in 2019 after he was hit by a distracted driver. Adrienne has since advocated for a distracted driving law in Missouri, which went into effect on January 1st. Let's dive back into their conversation. Here's Abby.
You've written that this was not an accident. Mm-hmm. I'm careful. I never use the word accident in mm-hmm. any of my reporting because there's right. a crash. We don't know exactly. In most cases, right. we don't
it's
know.
A crash, yes.
In this case, we learned more about the details and it held up that mm-hmm. it is not an accident. Mm-hmm. Elaborate on that a little bit for me. Why was this not an accident, or why is an accident not an appropriate way to describe this in your mind?
Right. Yeah. So even though she technically wasn't breaking a law by using her phone, she was by driving without a license, without driving uninsured, speeding. You know, those are all laws that she was breaking in the moment. And then the law that everybody kind of forgets about but also kind of uses as a catch-all, careless and imprudent driving, right? Like, okay, you're being careless, you're imprudent, you caused massive damage and personal injury. And so, you know, all of it stacking up together. And she – part of the reason she didn't have a license anymore is because she had had other instances of reckless driving occur. And therefore her license was revoked previously. So stacking it all up together, you know, she wasn't a person who had, you know, like a normal driving record with no instances of all these things happening. Like, she had repeatable offenses of recklessness. So anyway, so it all gets categorized and it ended up being multiple charges were brought against her. But just in the initial and moment, you know, how our justice and how our legislative systems work, it's all very retroactive. And that's always discouraging for victims and for people who these things have happened to.
What do you mean by that?
So, you know, that day she went, you know, she caused all this massive crash and wreckage and mayhem. She went to the hospital and she went home. Nothing happened to her. She wasn't, you know, because they couldn't even give her a speeding ticket, because you can't give her a lesser charge if you're going to charge her with something higher. And so, and you know, and this is stuff that you don't know until you've experienced it. Or if you work in, you know, if you're a police officer, or you work, if you're a lawyer, something like that, then you understand how the justice system works. Mm-hmm. But as a person who hasn't really dealt with any of that,
like
most people, right. Most of society, you don't realize it, because it makes, you know, and it made my family really mad. Like, why wasn't she arrested, or why wasn't anything? Well, they don't have the evidence to charge her with anything right now. You know, they had to do the investigation. They had to do, you know, so it wasn't until July that she was arrested for the original injury in May.
Wow.
And then charged with anything. And so, and then even then it's like, okay, so then now she's charged, she's out on bail, you know, and then COVID, which also delays things. But it was 2 years to the day from the original original crash that she was sentenced.
Yeah.
So it just, it takes such a long time for that, all of those processes to occur. And it's one of those, it's a terrible, terrible process to have to go through, because as human beings, I'd like to think we're compassionate and we show compassion towards other people. And, you know, she had kids. And so then, you know, everyone's like, well, she has kids. Like, you're going to take her away from her kids. I'm like, she took my kid's dad away from them forever. Like, 10 years is what she got, which is the maximum sentence. So I did get the maximum for what I could. And that is what I asked for. Because I'm like, that's such a small piece to, I have to go every day.
Yeah.
Like, I don't get it back. Like, you're going to get your life back eventually, and I hope you do better with it when you do. And I hope you become a better member of society from this, and I hope you take something away and try to be a better human. But you took it away from me forever, and I can't get it back.
How did you wind up becoming an advocate to get the law that made it so difficult for you to get justice in the first place changed in the state of Missouri and start acting against distracted driving?
I didn't pursue it. Like, I'm not the person, like, Randall was the person. He'd go out and tell you, like, if he had lived, he would have been the person, like, talking to whoever needed to be talked to get the law changed and affect change however he could have and inspire a positive change, right? I am not that person. That is not who I am. And so it actually fell in my lap, actually. AAA reached out to me, and I thought about it, and it definitely, like, torn back and forth. But like I said, it's something, if Randall had lived, he would have jumped at and he would have done. And so I was like, you know what? I'm going to share a story. And so I did. And I don't know. I guess I kind of thought it was going to be – you know, just like a one-time, you know, thing where I go and I, you know, share the story and that'd be the end of it. Well, then, you know, I show up and I meet, you know, a lot of people from MoDOT and some highway patrolmen and just a lot of people that were there. This is at the Capitol building that day. And, you know, they're like, would you be interested in, you know, joining the, just coming to Hands Free Coalition meeting. They're just Zooms where, you know, all of these organizations are coming together, and we're trying to, you know, pursue this law and pursue making this a change. And so I did. I was like, yep, sure. Add me to the call. I'd be interested to hear what you guys are talking about and that sort of thing. And then that's kind of where it started. I just, you know, I spoke once, said yes to joining, and then I just kept saying yes. Anytime they asked if I would come and, you know, share Randall's story or come, you know, be a witness at a house hearing, or anytime the laws had hearings, anything like that, you know, they're like, would you come share his story?
And when you had seconds maybe to get a lawmaker's attention, what would you say?
Mm-hmm. Most of the time, I would just describe the event of the day. I would just be like, he wasn't doing anything wrong. He shouldn't have died. Like, but because this law says it's okay for her to do that, my husband lost his life.
It's officially called the law that was, you know, officially passed eventually, the Siddons Bedding Hands-Free Driving Law. Mm-hmm. The other part, after Michael Benning, a 46-year-old hit and killed by a suspected distracted driver in Cass County in 2021, mm-hmm. apparently another husband and father mm-hmm. of two.
Mm-hmm.
how did it come to be that your name, that Randall's name, your family name was part of this law?
Yeah, that was a total shock and surprise. Like, that was Angie Nelson with AAA. I don't even know what she did. She did political magic somehow. And whenever the bills that were being presented, there were two bills that were actually being combined and going to make it. They were like, okay, these are going to make it across the line. Somehow in their final stages or whatever she did, since they'd combined two bills, they changed the name instead of it being bill. I forget what the numbers were, but they were two numbers, just random numbers. She had gotten them to name it after us. So, cause yeah, myself and, Stephanie Benning, we'd shown up, we had advocated a lot. We had done a lot of sharing our personal stories to affect the change.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you was what this whole process has taught you about the legislative process and affecting change. And it sounds like your big takeaway is that people need to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Because, yeah, I mean, they have 30 different organizations represented in the Hands Free Coalition, all actively working, bike organizations, trail organizations, you know, your massive, like, who doesn't think MoDOT and AAA and the Highway Patrol couldn't just get this, like, done on their own?
Wow, but then that's a great point.
Car dealerships, you know, you got, yeah, the car industries working towards making this happen, you know, things like that. You have all of these organizations working together. Insurance companies, they want this to happen. You know, you would think them on their own could do this. Well, they hadn't been able to for years and years and years. And the legislative process, with how it works, it's slow. It's mind-numbingly slow. And to get everything working and moving in the right direction and getting the numbers you need in the House and then in the Senate, and then it's got to go back and forth, right? And it's a painful process. And to then to have to start all over. So, like, the first year we did it, it went pretty far. Like, we got it through, you know, a few committee meetings and hearings and things. And then it just – we ran out of time. Like, the legislative session is only X amount of days, right? Like, they don't meet all year. Like, they don't work all year. And that's one thing. You learn it in high school, but you don't really remember that. But like how this works. Well, then okay, like you don't just pick up where you left off. You have to start again.
Mm-hmm.
So now every year you're starting over. You're never like, okay, we made it this far. We're gonna start here. We'll pick up here and we'll make it that far again. No, you have to start all the way over, and that's discouraging. But I ended up advocating for 3 years before we got it across.
The law went into effect August of 2023.
Yes.
And as of January 1st of this year, it's really being enforced with fines and penalties. You mentioned AAA a couple of times here. Mm-hmm. A public affairs specialist with Missouri's AAA has said that rates of distracted driving do tend to fall when the issue receives media attention.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the human factor of you sharing your story with lawmakers, then what about on the radio while people might be driving? Was any part of that motivation for even sitting down talking to me today?
I do hope that by me sharing, and sometimes I don't know if I say the right thing or if I say enough to like get the message across and to strike a chord with people. But I hope I do. And I hope that, you know, it just kind of, whenever people pick up their phone, they think about it like, oh, I could affect not only my life, but someone else's. Cause that's the thing. And as angry as I am and as angry as I was specifically at her, you know, she ruined her own life, like, by having to go to jail and now be away from her kids. And I don't want that to happen to other people.
I've heard people say that they're good at texting and driving.
It's comical.
I've heard people say that they're fine with FaceTiming or video chatting and driving because they're not looking at the screen. It's just the person's looking at them.
We're being you're receiving positive reinforcement for your negative actions. And it's
every time
it's
one
a
of
lie.
Them.
It's just a lie. It's false sense of security, and it only takes once.
So you're saying that every time that you sit there and you do respond to the text message or answer the video call while you're behind the wheel and nothing bad happens makes you think every single time you can keep doing it, but it only takes one time.
It only takes one time for you to drastically alter your life and others. Just one time.
For other people whose lives have been deeply impacted by external forces, who might see a path forward through change, who might see a hole in the system that enabled this bad thing to happen to them, especially, frankly, in a world where it can be really easy to feel disempowered. It can be really easy to feel like decision makers far away are the ones that are in charge of your life. What would you say to people who might be going through, if not a similar experience, but feeling like there is a hole that can be filled by their advocacy or action? What have you learned that you would share with them?
Yeah, don't be scared to share your story. You know, it's your story. You know, if you get out there, chances are other people feel the same way, have experienced something very similar, you know, or very parallel to what you've experienced. And by sharing your story and by, you know, finding outlets and things, you can find those people, right? Like, I shared my story once and I found this massive group of people all working towards one common goal of something that I supported 100%, you know, and that's one thing I think about too is the amount of people I've met that I wouldn't have otherwise. And I don't know, I think you shouldn't be scared. You know, lawmakers they're not as intimidating as you think. They all wear suits and they all act like they're kind of big stuff, but they're just people who have families, and most of them want to hear from you.
That was Adrienne Siddons in conversation with STLPR's Abby Lurico. You can find Abby's story at our website. That's stlpr.org.
This episode was produced and engineered by Abby Lurico. Edited by Abby Lurico and Emily Woodbury.
Podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.